Atismita prakshana basana dishu. Priyakriyasya pratiruda murtaya. Savahandvitya bilastadamika. Yavedishu krishna vihara vibramaha. Tatismita prikshana basana dishu. Priyakriyasya pratiruda murtaya. Asaham tritya balastadamika. Yavedishu Krishna Vihara Vibramaha. Okay. Gati.
Gati.
In his movements.
In his movements.
Smita.
Smita.
Smiling.
Smiling.
Prikshana.
Prikshana.
Beholding.
Beholding.
Basana.
Basana.
Talking.
Talking.
Adishu, and so on. Priya, the dear gopis, the Priyas. Priyasya, of their beloved. Pratiruda, fully absorbed. Murtaya,
their bodies.
Aso, he, aham,
I,
to,
actually,
iti,
speaking thus,
habala, the women, tatamika,
identifying with him,
yavedishu,
they announced,
Krishna Vihara,
caused by the pastimes of Krishna.
Vibramaha,
whose intoxication?
So the translation,
and I believe this has been done by Gopi Puranadana Prabhu in conjunction with Sri Dayananda Maharaj.
This is beyond the point where Srila Prabhupada translated.
Because
the beloved gopis were absorbed in thoughts of their beloved Krishna, their bodies imitated his way of moving and smiling, his way of beholding them, his speech, and his other distinctive features. Deeply immersed in thinking of him and maddened by remembering his pastimes, they declare to one another, I am Krishna.
I'll read it another time.
Because the beloved gopis were absorbed in thoughts of their beloved Krishna, their bodies imitated his way of moving and smiling, his way of beholding them, his speech, and his other distinctive features. Deeply immersed in thinking of him and maddened by remembering his pastimes, they declared to one another, I am Krishna.
There's a purport given here.
Spontaneously, the gopis began moving like Krishna. They smiled as he would smile, glanced boldly as he would, and spoke as he would. The gopis were completely absorbed in the existence of Krishna and mad with love at their sudden separation from him, and thus their dedication to him attained absolute perfection.
So as I mentioned in the beginning, this is a subject matter far beyond my capacity, but I thought to consider the example of Uddhava. In the earlier part of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Uddhava has come to Vrindavan and he has been stunned by the devotion of the gopis. And he expresses that being stunned. One of the verses is Pada Ranum Abhi Shanaras, means that I wish to just be a particle of dust at their feet. And in the Krishna book, Srila Prabhupada elaborates on this mood of Uddhava. I'll just read a few paragraphs from Krishna book, directly from Srila Prabhupada's Krishna book. Therefore, I wish to take birth, this is Uddhava speaking, as one of the plants or creepers in Vrindavan who are so fortunate that the gopis trample them. The gopis have so lovingly served Krishna, Mukunda himself, the giver of liberation, who is searched after by great sages and saintly persons. For his sake they left everything, their families, their children, their friends, their homes, and all worldly connections. Uddhava appreciated the exalted position of the gopis and wished to fall down and take the dust of their feet on his head. Yet he dared not ask the gopis to offer the dust from their feet. Perhaps they would not be agreeable. Therefore, to have his head smeared with the dust of the gopis' feet without their knowledge, he desired to become only an insignificant clump of grass or herbs in the land of Vrindavan. The gopis were so much attracted to Krishna that when they heard the vibrations of his flute, they instantly left their homes, families, children, honor, and feminine bashfulness and ran toward the place where Krishna was standing. They did not consider whether they were passing over the road or through the jungles. Imperceptibly, the dust of their feet was bestowed on small grasses and herbs of Vrindavan. Not daring to place the dust of the gopis' feet on his own head in this life, Uddhava aspired to have a future birth in Vrindavan in the position of a clump of grass or herbs. He would then be able to have the dust of the gopis' feet. So I thought this might be a befitting extension of the purport and meditation for us to consider why we are here in Vrindavan. That's some. In fact, we should regularly take an inventory of why I am doing what I do. What am I doing? What is the reason for it? Right? Why am I here in Vrindavan? Sometimes we find it very convenient to be in Vrindavan. Nice friends, nice prasad. It's quite fun, quite beautiful. Our lives are not so nice outside. But there's much more. There's much more. And Srila Prabhupada had very clearly told us that Vrindavan is not for enjoying household life. Vrindavan is for living like the Goswamis, who lived in the dust, who rolled in the dust, who did dandavats around the Govardhan and around the Vrindavan in the dust, just to get this dust which has been touched by the lotus feet of the gopis. And this is Uddhava's mindset here, that he wants that dust. So in the verse, we're hearing how the gopis have gone mad. You may recall sometimes children will imitate their parents. They'll even put their clothes on. I've seen children put the shoes of the father on, big shoes, and pretend, now I am the father. Right? And it's out of love. They're not envious of the father. They're admiring the father. They feel great love for the father. They're celebrating that personality in their life. It said that imitation is the highest form of flattery. So in this case, the gopis, they're imitating Krishna, but actually they're in such a state of madness, they even think they become Krishna. They're so absorbed in this person that they're losing their own identity. They're not sure who they are anymore. Therefore, it's described as a madness. Because what is a madness? It means you don't know who you are. That's the definition of madness. Your identity is lost. So this is a transcendental madness. That their identity has been lost completely in Krishna. They can't even distinguish any longer who they are and who he is. So out of this loving madness, they declare, I am Krishna. And they start behaving in different ways and mimicking his gestures, his movements, his speech, his movement of his eyes. And they're completely absorbed in remembering him. And of course, this is the mood of separation, which drives one mad. It's a sweet torment. A sweet torment. Which has... when we grow up, when we're little, we love to have sweets, isn't it? But as our taste becomes a little mature and a little refined, some of you may have this experience, the bitters, like Karela, Shukta, such things, they start to become very tasty. As a child, wouldn't consider it. But as you become a little mature, this bitter becomes more attractive than the sweets. I mean, at least I know for me, if you put a plate of fried Karela in front of me and a plate of sweets, I'll take the Karela any day. That bitter sweet, bitter wonder that's inside of that Karela, what to speak of Shukta, which combines various bitters, including mustard oil. So, and Srila Prabhupada was very fond of Shukta. So this means it's a more refined taste. And moreover, as you develop your taste, that even sweets that are not too sweet become more pleasurable, isn't it? It's like if you get kheer, and it's just mildly sweet, so you can taste the mixture of the rice, it becomes more pleasurable. So this is the refined taste. And the gopis, I mean, I'm giving a very crude analogy here. The gopis have such refined taste, and they're completely absorbed in all these beauties of Krishna. I was just standing in the back while you were all chanting and watching and thinking, what an amazing life Srila Prabhupada has given us, that every morning we attend such a beautiful function of such sweet people singing so beautifully the glories of God, and appearing, the Lord appearing in front of us in such magnificent forms. And not only that, he's receiving our offerings. What kind of a life can, I mean, how can you obtain such a life? How much money would it require to buy such a life? There's no price you can put on it. You can't buy it. You can't obtain it. It's praptasya. It's given. It's a gift. It's passed down when the guru is pleased, when the Vaishnava is pleased. That's what we say. Praptasya kalyana gunarnavas. It's given. It's not just that you develop it. No, it's given. And how is it given? It's given by begging for the dust of the lotus feet of the Vaishnavas. So when we're in Vrindavan, remember, this land, every particle of dust on this land has been touched not only by the Lord himself, by, perhaps more importantly, by his devotees, by Sri Radha and the gopis. Even he aspires for their feet on him. Even he, when he has a headache, he asks for the dust from their feet. So this dust, this land of Vrindavan, we should always remember we're in a very special place. This is really, it's covered, it's hidden, it's gupt. We see so many modern ugliness that's been put on top, right? But the art is to penetrate through that temporary ugliness and see the eternal Vrindavan, which is always here. Hold these trees, like sometimes you may observe me, I often hold this tamal tree or the tamal trees around, and I hold them for some time, and I pray to them that your roots are so deeply embedded in this sacred earth of Braj. Please give me that boon so that my heart will be similarly embedded, like your deep roots in Vrindavan. Right? So this should be our purpose, this should be our prayer every day and constantly, to call out the name of Krishna in our japa, sit properly, as Prabhupada says in his japa tape. You ever wonder why he says sit properly? Because sitting and chanting japa is the most difficult. You have that experience? Walking around, okay, very easy. Sitting and focusing the mind, this is very difficult. Of course, one has to walk sometimes. But the point is to focus, to hear the name, to call out the name of Krishna. Right? He's, just like the gopis realize, he's everything. He's everything. Anything that we see that's beautiful, anything we see that's attractive, that's sweet, that's full of love and purity, that's Krishna. That's Krishna. And in this place of Braj, Krishna is everywhere. But to see him, there's one very nice prayer from our songbook, which is describing how I can enter into Vrindavan. And this is written by Srila Narottam Das Thakur. So he says, Gauranga bolite habe pulaka sharira hari hari bolite nayane bobe nira harka bernitai chande karuna haibe samsara vasana mora kabe tucha habe. Here he tells, Vishaya chariya kabe shuddha habe mana kabe hama herbo Sri Vrindavana. Vishaya, when I become free of Vishaya, of the desire of the senses, only then can I actually enter into the experience of Vrindavan. So we're in a desperate condition, because even coming to devotional service, even intellectually knowing what we're supposed to be doing, somehow our heart stays somewhere else. Somehow the mind is off in the marketplace somewhere. Every time we look back in the brain, we see, where the hell did you go? What are you doing? Thinking about something absolutely useless, something so temporary, something so meaningless. When I'm trying to chant the name of Krishna, Krishna, I'm trying to subdue these senses. I'm trying to taste Vrindavan. So Vishaya Chaya Kabe Shudahabe Mana Kabehama Herabo Sri Vrindavana. So when we master these senses, when we follow the principles described by Srila Rupa Goswami and defined to perfection by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada for our time, then we can begin to subdue the senses. But believe me, from personal experience, I can tell you that you can spend decades, you can spend decades of your life in the association of the ISKCON devotees and the shelter of Krishna consciousness and still not take it seriously. I'm the perfect example of this. I've spent 53 years of my life pretending to be a devotee, trying to fool the Lord. It was easy to fool the other devotees. Some of you may even be fooled right now. But I have not been able to fool the Lord. He knows. And unfortunately, I also know that I have not mastered my mind and my senses properly. And now I become, in my old age, a little desperate, a little heartbroken that so much time is wasted just thinking that I have become advanced. But one does not become advanced by thinking he is advanced. One becomes advanced in the opposite way, by thinking I'm never going to be advanced. I'm just a pathetic failure, and I must fall at the feet of the Vaishnavas, and I must cry out the name of Krishna. And then maybe Vishaya Charya Kabe, maybe I can control the senses and taste a little bit of Vrindavan. So I thought these different ideas might help us to benefit from this verse. I felt a little trepidation in speaking on the 10th canto, and so I have tried to stay with our feet on the ground. As Srila Prabhupada, you noticed in his lectures, he was very much concerned with the basics. Right? Again and again, you're not this body, and you will die again and again. And that's because this is what we need to hear. So, this class goes until when?
9.
Until 9. So, it's about 8:30. Can any of you give me a question to help illuminate the subject? Prabhu?
Hare Krishna.
It's not on, yeah. I can repeat the question if you want, Prabhu.
Yeah. But thank you very much for such a wonderful class. I was interested in this verse that the gopis are saying, I am Krishna, in their madness of love. We know that demons think I'm the enjoyer, I'm the controller. We know that yogis and jnanis have trouble distinguishing themselves from the absolute truth as a separate individual. But how is that different? How are the gopis, who are the topmost devotees, saying, I am Krishna?
Yes, of course, we're in the early stages, we're drilled in the discipline of understanding the difference. You know, our philosophy is achinta beda beda tattva, but in the early stages, we're very much concerned with the difference between God and the jiva, right? Because that tendency, tainted by envy, is to view the Lord as same as me, but with envy. So this is always the determining factor, is the purity of the motive, right? And that's the subtle idea that has to be captured here. That, okay, the Maya body or the idiot may declare, I am Krishna, as we see, I am Krishna. But he wants to actually usurp Krishna, to take the position of Krishna, and he wants to enjoy the gopis. Literally, we see some gurus and some, I mean, they're not gurus, they call them godmen in India, godmen, because they think they're God. And they declare so many insane things. that they are God. But they say it out of envy because they want to take the position of Krishna. Whereas here the gopis are imitating Krishna, thinking they are Krishna, in a celebration of their love and the beauty of Krishna, of their love for Krishna. So that it, where it appears, just like I was just reading where Narada the other day, where Narada Muni goes to Dwarka and he observes Krishna doing in all 16 different palaces. He sees Krishna doing every kind of thing you can imagine, even doing householder business about money so he can pay his bills. Prabhupada mentions so he can pay his bills. And intimacy with his wives and all types of things he's doing at every palace, a different activity. And if you keep a mundane perspective, you might think, well, what's the difference between Krishna? Of course, number one, there's 16,000 of them. That's a little different. But number two, this is the prerogative of the Supreme Lord. He is Purusha. We are Prakriti. Actually, we're all female in the sense to be enjoyed by Krishna. There's a story told when Mirabai came to Vrindavan. She had always wanted to meet the Goswamis, the six Goswamis. But they were all gone by the time she came. Only Jiva was left, because you remember Jiva was a little boy when they began their manifesting their position as Goswamis. So only Jiva was remaining. So, of course, he was living very austere, terribly austere, frighteningly austere. And there was a secretary or a devotee who met her, and she said, I want to see Jiva. He said, oh, he's, you know, he's a sannyasi, he's a baba, he doesn't see women. And Mirabai said, oh. She said, I thought there was only one man in Vrindavan. And the disciple was, you know, shocked and realized this is not an ordinary woman. He told Jiva Goswami, and Jiva said, bring her, bring her, bring her. Because in fact, we're all to be enjoyed by Krishna. And that difference is the envy versus the desiring to be Krishna, actually to take Krishna. Whereas the gopis are in a madness of glorifying the beauty of Krishna and just like a play actor, you know, a good actor. In fact, I heard a very famous actor speak once. He was an incredible actor. He only did a few movies, but every one of the movies was just devastating. And there was discussion, it was a very deep discussion about him being an actor, and he was basically revealing that he became so identified with the part that he started to lose his mind. Because he, as a perfect actor, he let himself become that person. But then he had a problem afterwards, with his mental balance and remembering who he really was, right? So the gopis in their attraction to Krishna and their absorption in Krishna, sometimes they even lose their identity here. This, of course, it's not something we can imagine ourselves doing with our mind and our present heart, but it's a fact. And to hear these pastimes of Krishna, all the pastimes, Srimad Bhagavatam is all there. It's all supposed to be read. Everything in Srimad Bhagavatam is meant to purify our hearts. And I specifically chose to extend the purporting of this with the words of Uddhava. For somewhat the reason you're asking is to differentiate the actual way to observe this madness of the gopis. Uddhava demonstrates it by it made him just want to take the dust of their feet and just become a lump of herb or grass where the gopis, and this is the mood that we are not supposed to be charging ahead thinking that we are going to attain some great position. No, we're supposed to be servants of the servants of the servants and be eager to be that servant. And that is the sweetest position. It's the sweetest position. Those, you know, as we serve Srila Prabhupada and our whole family of gurus, Guru Varga, we find that joy to be unmatched. And when we actually sincerely serve and actually taste that sweetness, there's no question of wanting to be anything else. You know, I of course, I'm a failed devotee, but you know, I don't even think I want to go back to Godhead. I just think, I don't know, I just want to be where Prabhupada is and serve him. If he goes back to Godhead, I'll go with him. If he wants to go to hell, I'll go there too. I don't care. Because that sweetness is just, it's addictive. You can't give it up. So I'm quite surprised that some devotees who go away and seek out that secret inside deal where they can get right into the high levels of, I'm really surprised. The poor fellow. He never actually tasted how sweet it is to serve the Vaishnava. I can't imagine there's anything sweeter than that. So Uddhava, who's far above us all, has the desire just to let them trample on his head as a piece of grass in Vrindavan, or to have the dust all over him. Yeah. So did you get it working?
Yeah.
Thank you so much for a wonderful class too. I just want to ask you if you want to elaborate on this famous sentence coming from Prabhupada, work now, samadhi later.
Well, first of all, Srila Prabhupada is the expert doctor, and he knows what our condition is. When you go to a doctor, you might say, look, I used to be a great sportsman, right? But I'm all damaged, my knees are damaged. And will the doctor say, start running again? No, he'll give you physical therapy. You slowly, you know, take a little massage on the knee, put some hot pads on it, maybe put some herbs on it. Slowly, slowly, the body begins to heal. And eventually we can aspire to being, you know, healthy again. And of course, Srila Prabhupada is the expert doctor. And that's why we need Guru. That's why we need Guru. Once Srila Prabhupada was asked about that, do we have to have a living Guru? And Prabhupada said, otherwise, who will do this? He took the devotee next to him, he grabbed his ear, he said, who will do this? Right? So whether Siksha Guru, Diksha Guru, we must have always. Of course, Siksha is the thing we aspire to at this stage, because we're not ready to be let out on our own. You know, just come up with the most crazy ideas, you see. Of course, I've been around for a long time, and at least I think it is 53 years, kind of a long time. And I've seen all the whole time I was in leadership until, you know, last 10, 15 years, but well, even sometime during that. But I've worked with a lot of devotees, and I've seen every kind of insanity I could have ever dreamt of. Just amazing things that we come up with as soon as we're let loose, or as soon as we let ourselves loose, because we're not supposed to be loose. We're supposed to be bound up by the guru, and that's the safe position. Just like a great doctor, if we get the opportunity to have a great doctor, you know, we should be grateful and following his advice, and then we can be certain that we will heal. So work now, samadhi later was your question. And that's because we're not ready for samadhi. It's a very simple thing. When you can sit and chant 64 rounds without getting up, without your mind wandering, then we'll talk about samadhi. I think that might be a long way off for most of us. It certainly is for me. Just to chant 16 rounds sitting without the mind wandering is a big challenge. Big challenge. Again, I can't do it. I certainly can't do it. I'm always fighting the mind is running over there. As soon as I pull it back, it's going off that way again. Wait a minute. So how can I talk about samadhi? But work, when I am engaged in the devotional service, when I'm preaching especially, which is basically what I do. I go out into the villages in Rajasthan and I preach. And at least lately, that's what I've been doing. I've done other kinds of preaching throughout my life. But that's the time when everything becomes focused. Preaching is the very best meditation for us. Because when you see another soul who wants to know about Krishna, your compassion is stimulated. You feel eager to help them. And so you focus. Right? It brings your attention to a focus, and you want to make sure that every word is effective. And that becomes a type of samadhi. It's preparing us for samadhi. It is a type of samadhi, actually. I mean, you can preach forever. There's no need to sit in a lotus position, you know, in the future. It's not that that's what we're aspiring to. We should always want to glorify Krishna, right? And as Srila Prabhupada, he always wanted to help others, even in his most painful, last period of time. He only wanted to preach. I was, of course, with him. He asked me to stay with him. He said, never leave my side day or night, which is my permanent memory. The sweet instruction he gave me, never leave my side day or night. So I saw how much pain he was in, but I never saw him express it. I mean, because I was nursing and massaging for hours and hours and, you know, carrying him and caring for him, and so much pain he was in, but never expressed it. He only expressed how eager he was to help others. He was relentless. So this preaching is samadhi, and that was his samadhi, because he was, like the gopis, glorifying their Lord. Srila Prabhupada was always glorifying his Lord. He was in Vrindavan at all times. He never left Vrindavan. In his heart, just like as an adult versus a child, your mind is full of so much experience and elaborate thinking about everything compared to a child. You know? Child has a very simple mind, very simple thoughts. Right? I want a sweet. I want to get away with some mischief. I hope they don't find me. There's so many simple things that a child has. But when the adult speaks to the child thinks, yes, this is how he's thinking also, just like me. But at the same time as you're speaking to the child, you have a whole world going on inside of yourself, right? Because there's so much more dimension within you as you become an adult. You know? It's an analogy how Srila Prabhupada was. He was always in Vrindavan. He was always seeing his Lord. And like the gopis, you know this story, I tell it roughly because I don't remember exactly every detail, but he was spied upon, and I think it was his rooms in Los Angeles. There was a painting of Krishna throwing, who is the horse demon?
Keshi
demon. I think that's the so. And Prabhupada was spied upon, and somebody saw him, and he was doing this. He was imitating Krishna throwing the Keshi demon. How did that happen? This is the same mood as the gopis are displaying here. Was he thinking, I want to be Krishna? No. He was thinking, I want to glorify Krishna, and he's so great. What it must be. So, the Vaishnava, the gopis, are the ultimate Vaishnavas. They are more auspicious than Krishna himself. Because they bring immediate benefit to us. Srila Prabhupada is that auspicious person for us. He brings guarantee. Guarantee. He gave us a formula, and he made a deal with Krishna. And whoever comes to me and follows as best they can, even that will not always be perfect. He made a deal with, will you please let them come in to the spiritual world? And Krishna agreed. That's the position that Srila Prabhupada put us in. I remember when I was taking care of Prabhupada, the timing was relentless. I hardly slept, hardly had time for eating. It was just constant. And at one point I said, Srila Prabhupada, I can't finish my japa. It's impossible, Prabhu said. Just try your best. So I understood the deal was still on. He'd still made, he promised that he would still bring me to Krishna, right? So, of course, that's not a suggestion that you have any excuse. Maharaj.
Thank you for sharing us your experience with Srila Prabhupada. So, based on what you said, so whatever we're doing, if we're absorbed in our service, it doesn't matter what it is, and completely surrender unto the instruction of the spiritual master, that is also samadhi. Samadhi, real samadhi means we just have to like give up everything and be in a solitary place as your Krishna. So that was a very good point that you said, that preaching also is samadhi. And then you mentioned just now, or before, that Srila Prabhupada will take us back home, back to God, and whoever will follow his instructions. So my question is, what about those devotees who in the beginning they were with Prabhupada and then somehow some kind of circumstances happened, which is whatever it is, and then they chose to disassociate with the what Prabhupada, the Prabhupada's family, so to speak. I'm just querying, just asking whether it will be continuously Prabhupada's promise to them that will be fulfilled, that they will be able to be carried by Srila Prabhupada back home, back to Godhead, or they're on their own now.
A very illuminating question, Maharaj. Thank you very much. I would suggest that all of those followers of Srila Prabhupada, or anyone who served Srila Prabhupada with any type of sincerity and took him in their heart, will go back to Godhead. But, like Ajamil, he didn't go immediately. He had to come back and reform himself further. So, I'll be there. You can assure yourself of that. I'll be taking birth again and again. Which is why when I had a little school in South India, Gurukula, and I always get very strict with the cooks. I say, you damn well better make great prasadam because I'm coming back here to be in this Gurukula and I need good prasadam. So they'll finish. And as to, you know, we're all now at this time, you know, I'm an oldie, but most of us are taking initiation from Prabhupada's disciples. And that's all the family. That's all the same family. It's just like I sometimes say, suppose you're a Rockefeller, right? Now, John D. Rockefeller has been dead for, I think, 75 years. But it doesn't matter if you're a Rockefeller. If somebody says, oh, this is Mr. Rock, does it make any difference? You're a Rockefeller. And you share the family fortune. You know? So, in this cottage here, I was massaging Prabhupada, and Brahmananda Maharaj asked Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, will we be with you in Krishna Loka? And Prabhupada said, when the residents of Vaikuntha fly over Krishna Loka in their flower airplanes, they will look down and say, oh, look at the nice guru and his disciples. So it means all of us who have entered that family, whether Prabhupada's our grandfather or great-grandfather, we're all Rockefellers. We're in that family. Huh? We're followers of Prabhupada. And we'll all be with him. And our gurus, of course, will be with him. And there's a whole family that's gigantic, beyond what we know. Beyond what we know. Because where is Prabhupada preaching now? We can't even imagine. He may be in any place with any number of followers. They'll all be there also. That family is inconceivable. And, you know, we read in Nectar Devotion that to enter Vrindavan, one has to have the guidance and the holding the hand of a resident of Vrindavan. That's who Srila Prabhupada is. He's a resident of Vrindavan. He's always there. And his sincere followers will always be there with him. So whether he has his preaching further, certainly some of the devotees, not some, all of the devotees who came in his time had been preaching before, at least most, I can say. And they were, in response to Maharaj's good question, they're finishing up their work, and perhaps it will take more lifetimes. But those lifetimes are so fast. It's unbelievable how fast this all happens. I'll just demonstrate to you, if you can follow this, the mathematics of this for a minute. I once calculated the timing of Lord Brahma and how long Lord Brahma experiences, or how many years of Brahma are 1 minute is, 1 minute. Okay, and how many years of Brahma, right? So it's 60,000 years. It's 1 minute of Lord Brahma's life. 60,000 years. How many lifetimes will we live in 60,000 years if we're living less than 100 years? Quite a lot of lifetimes, huh? What is that, 6,000 years or something? Or more than that? 6,000 lifetimes, I mean. Huh? More than that in 60,000 years. Huh? How much perfection we can achieve if we follow Prabhupada faithfully in 6,000 lifetimes. Right? And Lord Brahma sees it as 1 minute. So he looks down on the earth after Mahaprabhu touches the earth with his lotus feet, and he sees people flying up to the spiritual world so rapidly. Lord Brahma is amazed. Within a minute, billions of people. That's why it's said that Mahaprabhu liberated the whole universe. Sometimes we may be mystified by that statement. What does it mean? But it doesn't take very long.
Marsh. Can one say that he is loyal to Srila Prabhupada still, despite his going to a different institution?
So, of course, that has to be judged on an individual basis. Some cases, one may be offensive to the spiritual master. It's possible. I think one has to evaluate situation by situation. I've known some who stayed very loyal. They had reasons that sounded pretty fine, that why they did, and they continued being devotees of Prabhupada. And then I've known others where I just couldn't make any sense of it. I'm like why? It's like a woman who's been married to a wonderful man, who's cared for her in every way, given her children, and died before her, but left her fully supplied with every necessity and fully satisfied in her life with beautiful children all around her to care for her. And then she goes and finds another man? Can you follow? It's an insult to the husband, isn't it? After he's fully satisfied her and fully cared for her, why are you running off to another husband? Is it simply for selfish enjoyment? You know? But there may be other cases, and I know there are other cases. I'm not the qualified person, but yes, Maharaj, thank you.
Thank you.
Ma? Go back. There's one lady in the back here. She has a good question, I think.
Questions, Guruji. I'm so happy to hear from you. I would like to know, from your experience of length of time of your life that you spent in Srila Prabhupada, we hear often that Vani is more important than Babu. But we don't hear so much how Babu is also important. And this has been something that's been going on in my mind related to my own guru, and I wanted to hear from you, your experience, what you would like to tell all of us regarding our Bhakti association with our gurus while they are still in Canada.
Well, I think when you become very clever, and Prabhupada once said, spiritual life is not for the unintelligent. When you become very little clever, that simply means that you have to stimulate your intellect. You have to bring it forward. It doesn't mean that some people are not going to make the grade, they can't come. It doesn't mean that. It means you have to become intelligent. So when you become a little intelligent, you'll start to see Srila Prabhupada, his qualities manifested in so many other devotees. You'll see him. You'll see little particles of him here and there. He'll come in your dreams. He'll come in your heart. And he will be very much real, very much present. So you'll have that personal association. When you take the instructions to your heart. So that was, to become in the time of Prabhupada's so-called physical life, you had to be a little bit willing to serve Prabhupada. You had to take in his instructions in order to come and interact with him. But that really was never, I'm not one to tell stories about how cute he was and how sweet things he said, and because I don't find those having that much impact. Of course, it draws my heart very close to him. But the real thing I see is the benefit he gave me through his instructions. That's the real gift of Srila Prabhupada. And through his example, right to the last breath, he was so concerned to show an example. He used to tell me when I was taking care of him in those last months, sometimes he would put his hand on me, which, like on my arm or something, as I was doing something. I mean, stop and listen, right? So I would stop and he would say, whatever happens, it must be glorious. And I knew what he meant, but I said, what, Srila Prabhupada? He said, my death, it must be glorious. Why was he thinking that? Did you think he wanted to enjoy that fame after he was gone? No, he wanted to gift it to you. He wanted to gift to you that example of the courage, the fearlessness of Bhai Charanaravinda, huh? He was absolutely fearless, right to the last breath. He was fully, not, you can't even say confident that he would be with Krishna. He was already with Krishna. What's the question of confidence? There wasn't any question to consider. He was right there with Krishna. He was seeing him at every moment. Just like in the story you've all heard, how Narada Muni came to the kirtan and Prabhupada was seeing Narada Muni. How was he doing that? And he was seeing into our hearts. And he was seeing into your heart. You may be a grandchild of Prabhupada, a great-grandchild, whatever it may be. He is Guru. As such, he is the manifestation of Paramatma, who is in your heart, who is always in your heart. And when Srila Prabhupada was writing his books in the middle of the night, he was writing love letters to you, to his grandchildren, because he knew you were all coming. And the grandfather, in somehow a very funny phenomena, that he has a father has unlimited love for the son, unlimited love for the daughter. He can't imagine he has any more love to give. And then the grandchildren come, and he has even more love. He feels somehow a deeper attachment. So Prabhupada is very much real for every one of you, and he is our Acharya. He is the Acharya. It's not that founder Acharya is a modifier, and that future will have a second Acharya or vice Acharya or, third Acharya. Of course, many could be technically Acharya, but the actual Acharya, the actual savior of this movement, the gold standard behind every one of your gurus that makes them potent, that makes them effective, is how they follow Srila Prabhupada and how he energizes them with his grace. And so that, I'm not sure I answered your question, but I have lovely memories of Prabhupada because I had that wonderful opportunity to hold him in my arms, literally carry him in my arms, bathe him, wash him, sleep next to him, you know, all those things, hold his hand while he slept. But it really doesn't seem to be more important to me than the great instructions of how to be saved. You know, that's the real important gift that he gave us. The physical presence is a gift also, and in different ways you hear about that physical presence and you each feel it, and you feel that sweetness. And of course, just like we want to hear about all the great Vaishnavas, we read about them and we relish their characteristics, as the gopis here relish the characteristics of Krishna to the point of insanity, right? So we also relish those pastimes. And, you know, some of us older fellows are lucky that we can be the mailman to tell you those stories. But I also want to underline that the instructions are the real important gift. And the physical stories are only to underline the instructions, to demonstrate the instructions, because he was the person Bhagwat, right? And every move, every step he took was Bhagwatam in life, you know. He was dancing Bhagwatam, he was speaking Bhagwatam, he was breathing Bhagwatam. He was the person Bhagwatam. And so everything he gave us, he put in his books. He put himself, he put his own soul inside of his purports. He's right there for every one of us to achieve. I'll just take them. Prabhu Gopal Prabhu, very senior devotee.
In response to, I think, Maharani's question, you know, for those devotees that leave ISKCON, what happens to them? And then, of course, your answer is that, of course, it's many, many births and deaths that it takes to become a Krishna conscious. But there have been devotees who left ISKCON, and one devotee in particular went to Srila Prabhupada and asked him to bless him that he could find
another guru. Yeah.
And
that's a great insult to Prabhupada.
Yes, and then Srila Prabhupada condemned him to go to hell. So
yeah.
We know that one of the 10 offenses in chanting the holy name is to blaspheme
the devotees who are dedicating their lives. Yeah. So that's, yes, probably the exception, isn't it? The elephant offense to the...
Yes, so if you fall to that level, then you, Prabhupada can retract his mercy from you, and then you'll be fending for yourself, so don't ever do anything like that.
Thank you, Gopal Prabhupada. Ma, she's quite enthusiastic here. If you keep asking questions, you're going to catch me making a mistake, so I'm getting a little nervous now.
Prabhuji, I hope this is not a controversial question that I will ask. But I understand that you've been in management for a long time. And just generally speaking, during service, if one experiences some difficulty in their own services, like bullying and things like that, like bullying?
What is that word?
Bullying.
Okay, yeah.
So, with anyone's seva to Krishna, could you please guide us? How do we deal with that?
Well, such things might happen in the company of very neophyte people, where they still have anger and cruelty.
Huh? Yeah, a neophyte experience both, I think.
Hmm. So one needs to associate with favorable, has to find devotees who are favorable to their development. And part of being favorable is that they should be kind to you. You know, the material world is beating us up enough. We don't need somebody to add, you know, an extra measure. And one should find friendly association where he feels comfortable to reveal their heart, to be vulnerable, and to hear from that person and share gifts and affection, to share prasadam. This is very important. I have seen a number of devotees who come to talk to me with different troubles in devotional service, that they don't understand the idea of association. I ask them about their association because it's so crucial. And sometimes they'll say, well, I'm in ISKCON. I'll say, okay, but where's your association? I'll say, well, I'm an ISKCON. Wait a minute. The ISKCON is an institution. It's a wonderful thing. Just like we have this temple. It's a wonderful thing. Or let's say a better example is a house. We appreciate the house. We take care of the house. We keep it clean. We keep it repaired. We're very grateful we have a house. But the house is not that's not the association. The institution is not the... Within the institution, like within the house, we can have very nice family interactions because the house shelters us. But we still have to have those active associations within that house. So within the house of ISKCON, you must find good association. And I can't remedy the fact that we will be abused by this material world. I have been abused. I've still got knife scars in my back. You will be abused. This is the nature of this world. But seek out kind and serious association. That's a very important part of devotional service. Just being around isn't enough. You have to actually be in a place where you reveal your heart. Sin happens in secret. Just like when man and woman want to enjoy, they turn the light on. Why do they do that? Because it has to happen in secret. So don't allow any lights to be turned off. Always reveal what you're doing, who you're talking to, what thoughts are coming in your mind. When you reveal them, you clean that dirt out of the brain. If you let it sit there secretly, it will turn into cancer. So, you know, I had learned that now in this life especially, even if I have a conversation with a woman, I immediately tell a friend, oh, I just talked to so-and-so. I just disclose it. And sometimes my friends say, what are you telling me that for? What do I care? And I say, no, I just thought I'd tell you. Because you don't keep anything in secret. And you need those kind of friends. So everything is revealed, right? And then you can be in a clean environment. And those devotees should be very supportive. Srila Prabhupada told Jamuna, which is a long story, but in the simple question she asked about association, Prabhupada said, 2 or 200, but it must be favorable. So that's the best I can say in a general way. I know that I'm holding some of you, but yes, Ma.
Hare Krishna. Thank you very much for the class. Can I just say something in regards to just what Mataji said about bullying? Can we look at it this way, that it's like a teaches us tolerance, it's a mercy, and it's for our purification? Some, can we think in that manner, and then maybe it will change? Can we take that way?
Yes, of course you can, and it's not wrong what you said. But there's a point where it can degrade your sense of self, it can pain you too much, and it can distort. You know, you might start thinking that the anger and the envy of this person is actually an accurate thing, it's describing me. Now, when you're advanced, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati gave, you know, such stellar examples of that. When there was one man who was his very vicious critic, and he died. And when the devotees reported to Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, he died. And Siddhanta Saraswati was sad, and they said, Maharaj, why are you sad? He was so cruel, abusive to you. And Bhaktisiddhanta said, no, he was my best friend. But that's a very high level. We have to be realistic, be practical. That's why we need senior devotees to talk to and guide us. And, you know, we're in the hospital. We have to take steps. We don't just jump to the cured stage. We have to go through the steps and heal properly. So better to avoid in the early stages such things. There's enough abuse in the world. Don't worry, it'll always be ready for you when you need it. Is that okay? Yes, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna. My name is Abhishek Dixit, and today is my 25th birthday. So I belong to a Brahmin family, and when I was a kid, throughout my childhood, I mean, my parents always taught me that, you know, you have to believe in Krishna. So, so I took majors in philosophy, right? I did my master's in philosophy, and now I'm confused. Should I really believe in God or not? I mean, does it really exist or not? I'm just, you know, stuck somewhere in between. Because if I have to believe in them, I just need some proof. I mean, that philosophy taught me, right? But somewhere I believe, you know, there is something. I mean, there is this light, I don't know what it is. But I'm still trying to understand. And as a student, it is, you know, I'm becoming more and more confused about it. I cannot sleep. You know, I'm a science student, right? I'm a scientist, philosopher, student, of course. So I'm just, you know, in this particular path where I cannot find myself, and I'm being stuck. So that's why I chose to be here on my 25th birthday. I would like to appreciate if you could, you know, enlighten me.
So when you studied philosophy, was that the Western philosophies, like Hegel?
So I took my majorship, and in the first year, we had this Indian philosophy, and in the second year, we had this Western philosophy.
Right. Well, I won't go fully into it. I'll just make a small comment. I do have a lot of reference and could discuss with you for many hours because I've studied a lot of philosophy and a lot of history. But basically, you study enough philosophy and you'll become an atheist.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
No, you will. I had a son who was stimulated by my whole life. I spoke philosophy to him and history and... So he went and studied in university, which I was basically against, but, you know, mothers are, you know, they want the son to get the proper degree. So he went to all the best universities, and he got a degree in the history of philosophy, history of ideas. So it's both history and philosophy, right? How philosophy affected history. And he became an atheist. And only by gradually again talking to him that he could come back to see that it's not the right conclusion. Heisenberg, so I think it was Max Planck and Heisenberg, they won the Nobel Prize in 1932 for being the fathers of quantum mechanics, quantum physics. And Heisenberg said something very interesting. He said, when you study the physical sciences, sorry, let me rephrase it how he said it. He said, when you begin to drink from the glass of the physical sciences, you become an atheist. Physical scientist means biology, chemistry, etc., etc. He said, you become an atheist when you begin, he said, drinking from that glass. He said, but God is waiting at the bottom of the glass for you. What does it mean?
it means that when you become a real scientist, not these puny little punks who teach in universities, they're idiots. They're just repeating what they read in a book. They're not really thinkers. They're not really writing new ideas and, you know, pioneering new insights. They're just little parrots just repeating, you know, with great conviction, you know, that Darwin and, you know, all this nonsense. But Heisenberg was not that level. Heisenberg, he was on a level where universities were begging him to take degrees, take more PhDs, because it would raise their prestige by being able to say, oh, Heisenberg has a PhD from our school, right? And that's what he said. He concluded that God is waiting at the bottom of that glass for you. Means that when you really dig in deep, you'll find out there's no other answer. So what you can do with your learning is keep learning, but learn now from the greatest rishis, right? And you'll see that every single stone that your modern philosophers have turned was already turned, and turned far more introspectively and have gone much deeper into the subject matter and illuminated exactly the real conclusions. So it's a long and arduous journey now that you've started to develop that philosophical intellect, but it can make you a very effective speaker in future when you reach that stage of enlightenment. And similarly in science, all the sciences will ultimately conclude in Krishna. They will, actually. Just like, you know, the whole Western world is swimming in two types of water. Well, let me say, they're swimming basically in Christian theology. Even the atheists, the whole Western zeitgeist, the whole Western paradigm is basically Christian theology, which is a really wacky theology. Basically, God is angry. Somebody ate an apple. He can't get over it. And we need some blood. And now God, okay, we killed a really saintly person, and now God's happy. He's okay now. I mean, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, no intelligent man can make any sense of this. It's blood sacrifice. It's human sacrifice harking back to the most primitive ideas, right? So Christianity is one thing. The other thing is Darwin. And Darwin is absolute rubbish. Not because I have a prejudice, but scientifically I can prove. And many scientists are proving. It's not just me. I'm only going to quote them. Darwin has been abandoned long ago. Just at the development of microbiology, Darwin's idea became impossible, beyond possible. All right? Some probability mathematicians did a calculation of the probability of one amino acid. You need seven, I think, to support life. That doesn't even make life, that just supports life, right? Seven amino, but one to be formed by accident, which is Darwin's proposal, right? There was this, he said, a muddy soup, some lightning came, kind of like a Frankenstein movie, and, you know, it erupted in life, and eventually the lizards crawled out, and, you know, everything else, okay? So, the actual fact is that the chance of one amino acid forming by accident, they calculated on a supercomputer, I think it was 24 to the 64th power. 24 to the 64th power is twice the number of atoms they estimate in the entire universe. That's the probability of one amino acid forming. It's so far beyond the definition of impossible that these scientists who propose this or explain this now, they say, you're not even a child if you want to present Darwin anymore to us. Just don't even talk to us. You're such an idiot. Because it's so impossible. That's just one amino acid. Now you need six more. Then you need them to cooperate. The probabilities are beyond the number of atoms and the whole creation that it could have happened. But to top that off, even if that happened, it has to happen in continuity. That means in the next moment, in the next moment, in the next moment, in the next million years, in the next billion years, it has to keep happening. The probability is beyond the number of atoms in the entire creation. It means it is way beyond impossible. It never happened. Could never happen. And only an idiot or an arrogant, envious person will stick to this proposal. So the entire Zeitgeist, the entire paradigm of Western society is based on a totally false premise. And, you know, the scientists who have come to realize this, they're scrambling because they don't all want to be religious. Some of them want to be atheists. But they're honest enough where they admit that our whole foundation is gone. Even neo-Darwinism, it's gone. It's wiped out. It could never have happened, and it didn't happen. Right? But science says, basically, allow me one miracle. Just accept one miracle, and then I can explain everything else. What is that one miracle? That those amino acids came together and supported. Of course, they think it formed life. We say, no, it just supports life. Life rests upon it. They say, no, life springs out of it, right? But they have, this is not so unscientific. You can't show one instance, not one instance, never, ever, of that ever happening, of life coming out of a mix of chemicals. You can have, how many laboratories are there in the world today? How many chemicals are being mixed together? How many times has just a little life form sparked out of it? Even for a second, never. What are the chances of that, if that in fact is true? If chemicals create life, they don't. That's why it can never happen. So, just if you have stimulated your intelligence, take it all the way. Take it all the way until you find what is the objective of quantum physics? It's to drill down and find the final substance on which everything rests. So we went to the atoms, then we went to the proton, neutron, electron, then inside that we found the quarks. Beyond the quarks, they're still scratching their head. They don't know what these quarks are because they really don't exist. They're just little, they can just see little sparks happening and then they're gone. So what the hell is that? And that makes the proton, neutron, electron. And in the atom, there's no other substance except the proton, electron, neutron. 99.99999999999% of the atom is zero, empty, nothing but space. And it's only these tiny little dots, electron, proton, neutron, bumping around, right? And they seem to be nothing. So what the heck is going on? They're completely mystified, right? And this is the actual, follow it up to Krishna. And if you don't follow it up to Krishna, you're in ignorance. The peacock feather has an eye, but it doesn't see anything. The scientist has an eye, but he doesn't see anything. So be a real scientist. Take it all the way. There's a quantum physicist, if you're into science, you can read. His name is Goswami. Obviously, he's Indian. I think he teaches at Seattle University. And he's quite a champion of this very deep quantum physics that points to God, right? And it's clearly obvious. Our rishis were already there long ago. They really were. And now you're seeing the archaeological evidence, the fossil evidence and the archaeological evidence that there were advanced civilizations, far more advanced than ours, existing before the Ice Age and before these big devastating events that took place and wiped them out. They were there because history is cyclical. It's not linear, and that linearness is another Darwinian, it's another atheistic idea, right? That it's linear. That we go back and it was primitive and now we're going forward. And we're now modern. Really? This is some achievement? Are you kidding me? I mean, imagine what the aliens think. They come down. You know why the aliens don't talk to us? They're frightened of us. These people are nuts. They hover over one of our cities. Suppose they hover over Delhi. They see in the morning, cars are rushing in. They're going, So the aliens are thinking, oh, something great is going to happen here. They're really, the people are all worked up. They're getting up early. They're driving into the city. And now they're churning things around. They're doing all kinds of things. They're on the phone. They're moving things in factories. And then in the evening, everybody goes out and they're going home. And the atheists are, they must have produced gold or something wonderful in all that effort. And they're looking at, well, there's some pollution, there's some sewage in the river, there's some wrecked lives. I'm not seeing it. Where's the gold? Where's the good stuff? What the heck is this society that we can be proud of it? It's an embarrassment. It's an embarrassment on the so-called idea that man has evolved. This very word modern is pregnant with arrogance, as if it means we've come up above our ancestors. Well, I don't know about you, but I'm not half the man my grandfather was. And that's just two generations back. If I had the morality of just my mother and father and the character of just my mother and father, I'd be far ahead in life. Right? So I don't know where this idea of evolving forward is. It doesn't seem apparent to me.
Thank you so much. I guess I can channelize with the I know where to, how to find my answers and, how to go deep in. Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Can read Stephen Meyer, David Berlinski, Goswami, if you want to dissolve the illusion of current scientific proposals.
Yeah. Repeat the first name again. The first name again.
Hare Krishna. Pardon?
Can you just read the first name again?
Stephen Meyer.
Thank you.
So I've forced all of you to be polite and stay. I'm sorry for that. And please forgive my personal presence here, lack of qualification. But it's been very inspiring to be with you. And I'll end here. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.